Earlier today, I spoke with His Majesty the King to request the dissolution of Parliament. The King has granted this request, and we will have a general election on the 4th of July. This election will take place at a time when the world is more dangerous than it has been since the end of the Cold War. Putin's Russia is waging a brutal war in Ukraine, and will not stop there if he succeeds. That war has also made it all too clear the risk to our energy security. In the Middle East, the forces of Islamist extremism threaten regional and ultimately global stability. These tensions are exploited by extremists who seek to undermine our values and divide our society here at home. China is looking to dominate the 21st century by stealing a lead in technology. And migration is being weaponized by hostile states to threaten the integrity of our borders. These uncertain times call for a clear plan and bold action to chart a course to a secure future.
Well, so there you have it. Snap election in Britain. Yeah, things can only get better. Who's excited? I know I am, Will. How about you?
I'm excited. I've just been recruited, actually, to be the Labour candidate in Islington North. Very excited to bring a modern progressive vision to a riding that very much needs it.
Well, you're alluding, of course, to the fact that one Mr. Paul Mason is making, I don't know, this must be like his seventh or eighth attempt to be a Labour Party candidate now in the Starmer era. And he has been turned down every time. I saw there's like a short list of two people they're considering, and he's not on it. I saw my colleague David Broder put it this way. He said, Paul Mason keeps trying to sell out, but no one's buying. So look, for those of you who aren't into the weeds in British politics, Paul Mason is a guy, I mean, you're probably familiar with him. He was a journalist on Channel 4 News. He was their economics editor, one of the leftier people on British TV. You know, he, I think, became especially prominent when he was covering events in Greece roughly 10 years ago. I suppose it's a little less than 10 years ago. And, you know, he was a supporter of Jeremy Corbyn as well. He was somebody with, I don't know, shall we say some odd views. In the one conversation I ever had with Paul Mason, he was defending the idea of nuclear weapons. He thought it was a good idea. It seemed like he at the time was supportive of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, but he didn't like that Corbyn didn't want to renew Trident, which I thought was a little bit of a puzzling position to take. In any case, when Keir Starmer was elected, Mason, I think, made a very deliberate effort to try to be before he was elected, in fact, he supported Starmer's leadership bid, and he made a very conscious effort to establish himself as a sort of house intellectual of Starmerism. And look, I'm not going to run through all the history since it is his many bizarre pivots and ideological feints and attempts to justify them are too numerous and convoluted to recapitulate here. But yeah, he's tried to stand as a Labour candidate a number of times and not made it through the vetting process or not been shortlisted to even get to run for a nomination. And it was just 2 days ago, I think, that he announced, oh, I'm seeking, you know, I want to be Labour's candidate in Islington North, the constituency long held by Jeremy Corbyn, who as of today has just announced that he is planning to run as an independent, having been banned from running as a Labour candidate. Anyway, we might have had a Corbyn-Mason matchup. We're going to get instead a matchup between Corbyn and someone else. Maybe Mason will be gifted a seat somewhere else, I guess we'll see. But if I'm in London, I'm spending the next 6 weeks in Islington North. That's what I'd be doing. If you're there, I'd encourage you to do the same. But I mean, look, this general election, I saw a poll, the results of the current polls, the Tories are something like 21 points behind the Labour Party, what Westminster would look like if an election were held today. And I saw a graphic of that paired with the current standings in the North Korean assembly, whatever it's called. And it basically looks the same. It's just like a sea of red with Britain's case, a handful of Liberal Democrats, SNP members, Tories, Plaid Cymru, etc. I have some doubts, and you know, hopefully if I'm wrong, no one remembers this in 6 weeks. If I am wrong, I'll eat my words, but I have a really hard time imagining the Tories actually finishing this election 21 points behind. I think that they will most likely regain some ground. I think there's an outside chance. I think Starmer could still bungle this. We'll have to see. The dynamics going into this election are very different even though the polling is similar in some ways, very different from 1997, which off the top there, I mean, Rishi Sunak announcing this snap election, it seemed like he kind of did everything right in terms of keeping the snap election secret until, you know, less than 24 hours before he made that announcement. But the optics of the announcement could not have been worse. I was watching it live when it happened, and there'd been some talk that because of the rain, he was going to do it inside Downing Street, but he defiantly decided he was going to come outside of Downing Street. It started raining, and there was very loud music blasting for much of his, insipid little speech. And someone, I'm not sure if this has been reported on anywhere, you know, started blasting this song, "It Can Only Get Better," which the Labour Party used in the 97 campaign. That was their, I think, official campaign song. But things are very different from 1997, vis-a-vis the Labour Party in particular. It's true, there's a huge lead in the polls. I don't know what the Labour lead was at the start of the 97 campaign, but, you know, everyone knew that Labour was going to win. Blair was personally very popular. New Labour, for better or for worse, I mean, obviously the latter, but, you know, New Labour was new and people were extremely excited about it. There were some parallels, right? I mean, the Tories had been in power for 18 years then. They've been in power for 14 years, I believe, now. But people are not excited about Keir Starmer. His personal approval ratings are extremely low. And my feeling is that there's been so much focus on the Tory party for the last few years. I mean, you think about all of the, like, the depredations of the Tory party that have made global news, from, you know, Boris Johnson and Partygate to, I mean, the Liz Truss premiership, which might have been shorter than this election campaign is about to be. I mean, it was, what, 40 days or something like that? There's been so much focus on all that stuff that I really don't think the Labour Party under Starmer has gotten very much scrutiny. And I don't think they're really offering very much except a very bland technocratic idea of change. And in this climate, that may be enough. I mean, they may be able to win. They're certainly calculating they can win on that basis. Regardless of the outcome, I'm not confident enough to predict who is going to win at this point. Obviously, Labour would be the odds-on favorite. But I am, at the outset of this campaign, I think, leaning towards the idea that the Tories, I have a hard time imagining them facing total oblivion or finishing, you know, 21 points behind. I guess we'll see.
Doesn't it feel like every election or impending election in the Western Hemisphere is a battle between a sort of spent, reactionary incumbent government versus like a placeholder candidate who's a sort of watered down version of same, but who is at least not same? Like, this is a few years after, like, various populist left-wing movements in electoral politics were squashed. And in lieu of anything replacing them, there's just sort of a dim hum in their place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think for, you know, the, you know, there's a class of operatives and a niche of the electorate in places like Britain, the United States, where, you know, I guess in the United States, I agree with your characterization. In the United States, though, the incumbent government, it is the dull, technocratic, nominally left of center option. But
as I suppose it is here in Canada as well, although...
No, but your basic point stands. I mean, this is what the immediate future of, you know, electoral politics in many countries appears to be. And just to return to what I was saying a moment ago, I think this is what a class of operatives and, you know, niche of voters and others who are traumatized by the two Bernie Sanders campaigns, by the Corbyn leadership of the Labour Party, that sort of thing. This is what they wanted. What they want is elections that pit, you know, some kind of revanchist right against an extremely broad, like ostensibly ecumenical, but really just ideologically vague and nonspecific cipher option that is in the center. I'm forgetting which Starmer aligned operative or comms person said a few weeks ago that basically, like, one of their hopes is once they take office, you know, you won't have to think about politics anymore, essentially, which was very much, I think, a significant part of Joe Biden's allure as well. And I don't know. I mean, there are certain contexts. Every country is different. Every country has different political dynamics, you know, and in Britain, the Tories are the incumbents. And in, you know, North America, as you pointed out, you know, it's these nominally center-left incumbents. But countries may have their own dynamics. And sometimes this sort of bland technocratic approach, I think, can win elections. Sometimes it doesn't. You know, just ask Hillary Clinton. But regardless, I don't see how getting beyond the short term, this is really a durable project. It seems to me it can only exacerbate the deep malaise with politics, the kind of demobilization and demoralization within electorates that we've, you know, it's been ongoing for the past, you know, 25 or 30 years. Like, I don't see, like, Starmerism, for example, is not a coherent philosophy. And, you know, if the Labour Party takes power under Starmer, it is pledged to basically operate within the same, you know, fiscal rules in which the Tories operate. So, you know, there are many problems with the British consensus of the past 15 years, but I mean, the chief one is austerity, and Labour is going to continue it. It is explicitly pledged to continue it. So this, to me, puts a different symbolism on that song playing at Rishi Sunak's press conference. You know, to me, the symbolism of that moment is already that, you know, you've got this extremely weak, unpopular Tory prime minister giving a typically insipid general election speech where he's talking about, you know, stability, security, blah, blah, blah. And then meanwhile, in the background, you got the Labour theme song from 1997. Both of these things set against, you know, a backdrop of just like, it's gray, you know, it's pouring with rain. And so, you know, you got Rishi Sunak delivering the speech, and then you've got the Starmer Labour Party waiting in the wings. But the song doesn't sound excited and triumphant. To me, it just sounds kind of morbid and funereal. It's like, well, the Big C Conservatives are going to lose. And, you know, in all likelihood, good news, they're going to be replaced by the Small C Conservatives. You know, it can only get better.
Well, welcome to Michael and Us. I am Will Sloan, here as always with
Luke Savage. Welcome back, folks. We, you know, we know you all so well. Sometimes we forget to introduce ourselves.
All this stuff depresses me a lot. So the past week or two, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about a subject that always makes me happy, which is the late filmmaker Roger Corman, who passed away this month.
Yes.
At the age of 98, folks.
Wow.
98. Not a bad run, would you say? I've been thinking about him a lot lately, and I've been revisiting some of his films, and I've been thinking about why it is exactly that he's fascinated me so much as a figure pretty much for my whole life. I remember, like, reading his autobiography from the library when I was, you know, 12 or 13. Obviously saw a bunch of his movies on Mystery Science Theater, came to know his reputation as a producer-director of low-budget exploitation movies, also famously the man who gave crucial mentorship to and early backing to filmmakers as esteemed as Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, Jonathan Demme, Peter Bogdanovich, many others. And I think it's that nobody has more perfectly embodied the central, let's call it, dilemma of cinema as an art form, which is that it is both an art and a business. You can say that all art forms are a business, and that would be true, but some are more business than others. And film, you know, which is a massive, expensive undertaking, very collaborative in nature, and very slow moving in nature as well. You know, it's like trying to steer the Queen Elizabeth, or maybe the Titanic. And I truly can't think of anybody who has embodied that paradox better than Corman. You know, he's somebody who got into movies very much as a businessman, and I think he never stopped being a businessman. He was somebody who in the 1950s would make movies for a very small amount of money for independent theaters and drive-ins as the major studios were beginning to lose their monopoly on such theaters, and they would have exploitable subject matter, you know? But he was an intelligent man, he was an ambitious man, and as the 50s turned into the 60s, you see the businessman and the artist kind of battling. There was a film he made in 1962, and whenever he talked about his career, whenever his career has been eulogized, this is the one that's always brought up as, well, this was his bid for art. This was him being a serious director. It's a film called The Intruder, which starred a young pre-Star Trek William Shatner as a racist demagogue in the South. And I think it's Shatner's best performance. I mean, not having seen everything he's ever done, I think he's extraordinary in the film. It plays to all of his strengths. And the movie was quite ahead of its time. It was also the first Roger Corman movie, famously, to lose money. It just didn't get bookings in the sorts of theaters where his movies typically were booked. the movie was too ahead of its time. It was too blunt and honest about race in America. And so the way that he always talks about his career, it's like, well, I learned my lesson from that. And from that point forward, it was no longer 100% art. It was, you know, putting art in the crevices of Dreck. You know what I mean? But I also think that that would be an unfair categorization of his work, because in the 60s, first he had an extraordinary series of movies based on the books of Edgar Allan Poe, starring Vincent Price, you know, House of Usher, Pit and the Pendulum, Mask of the Red Death.
Mask of the Red Death, right? That's the one I'm most excited to watch. That sounds great.
It's so good. And it has incredible cinematography by Nicholas Roeg, who of course became the director of The Man Who Fell to Earth and Don't Look Now. When that cycle wore itself out, he then made a number of films that were very consciously going after the sort of generation gap zeitgeist. The Wild Angels, The Trip, which was this ambitious attempt to depict an LSD trip on film. Those movies, which starred Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper, and The Trip was also written by Jack Nicholson. Those movies directly made possible Easy Rider, which, you know, is just a small example of his vast influence on the second half of the 20th century. And, you know, in these movies, I would include The Intruder in this as well. You see someone who is both producer and director. You see someone who is extremely conscious of, I'm investing my own money in these movies. I have to make subjects that are going to get asses in seats. But in this run of movies, you also see his experimentation within those confines. You see how genuinely earnest excited he was to be playing in the zeitgeist and trying to catch the zeitgeist on film. And in the 70s, when he basically retired as a director, he started his own company, his own distribution and production company called New World Pictures. And that's where so many of those directors who he gave their starts to began. You know, young, hungry, often grossly underpaid talent who were given quite a bit of freedom within narrow confines, and the ones who did good work ascended to the next level. Just as one example, I still think Ron Howard's best movie is Grand Theft Auto, the car crash movie that he made for Roger Corman.
Well, apart from EdTV, obviously.
Oh, sure. And How the Grinch Stole Christmas, also very strong. It was, by the way, with this company that Roger Corman also briefly flourished as a distributor of foreign arthouse films. Among others, he distributed Ingmar Bergman's Cries and Whispers, Fellini's Amarcord, Herzog's Fitzcarraldo, several films by Truffaut. Back at a time when movies like that, you know, he could acquire them for pennies, basically. And he was able to use his showmanship and entrepreneurial knowledge to give these movies a sort of Hollywood treatment on a budget. The last several decades of his career are not quite as noble as that. In the 90s, the 2000s, a lot of direct-to-video erotic thrillers and bad monster movies. There were very few cult classics that he made in the last 30 years. Sharktopus is an example of the sort of movie he was making towards the end.
How recently was he working? I mean, when did his last film come out?
I mean, it's probably a little debatable how much a 95-year-old guy is working, but as recently as a month ago, he was announced as the executive producer on a remake of Little Shop of Horrors. Throughout the 2010s, he was producing movies for the Sci-Fi Channel, you know, Dino Croc, Sharktopus, that kind of thing. I mean, it's unrealistic to expect that a guy is going to keep on the zeitgeist for his entire life. And, you know, ruling the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and even into the 80s the way he did is not a bad track record. But yeah, looking back on some of his movies, part of what's interesting about the career is, you know, there's both triumph and tragedy in what it represents. There's triumph in the art that he was able to bring these movies in the 50s and 60s. Movies like A Bucket of Blood, Mask of the Red Death, The Intruder, The Wild Angels, The Trip, all of his best movies from that era. And there's tragedy in the fact that ultimately, at a certain point, the businessman side of his personality won. And that's what he was in the last three decades of his life. I say tragedy, like I say, he did so much. You could make a case that through the people he hired, through the trends that he started, even through the movies he himself made, he was the most influential single American film industry figure of the last 60 years. So that's not a bad legacy. But yeah, it's those paradoxes in his career that I think are what will endure in my mind about him.
The artist, the poet, the figure model, who loves to show it. All these are beat. All these you'll meet in a bucket of blood.
Now, we do have a movie to talk about on this episode. In fact, it is a movie picked by the superdelegate patron tier. If you subscribe at the $10 a month level, you get to nominate movies and vote on movies for us to discuss. And hey, why don't I just briefly tell you, patreon.com/Michael and us, we have been in the midst of a series, and we're going to do another episode this week, and then we might take a little bit of a break. But we've been in the midst of a series doing a deep dive into Aaron Sorkin's greatest television show, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, in which the master, the king of dialogue, the god of center-leftism, decided to bring all of his West Wing juice to the most important subject, TV sketch comedy. So we've been having a great time watching that. And folks, if you're a patron and you're getting impatient with our Studio 60 discussion, don't worry, we will take a break from it shortly. But I gotta say, the reception seems to be pretty rapturous. I think people have been enjoying it as much as we have.
There's barely been a hint of dissent. People are calling it peak Michael and Us content, what the show was made to do. People have begged us to be even more granular in our analysis. Don't just, you know, analyze episodes. Go through scene by scene. Talk about every
Luke
line.
Luke is not,
you know,
joking. Luke is being serious. That is what they have been saying. So
I mean, you know, I'll say for my part, it is some of the most fun I've had talking about anything on this show. And we've had a lot of fun on this show. So if you've been on the fence about subscribing, this would be a good time to do so. I will also just say, you can subscribe for free as well and just sort of get everything in one place. Patreon.com/Michael and Us is also a great place to follow the show, and you can do so in a way that costs you nothing, even if you don't want to subscribe at the Al Gore tier. We post messages there, we post updates, we post bonus content as well, some of which is unlocked. But yeah, if you've ever thought of subscribing, now's the time to do so. We're having a lot of fun.
Well, it's time to travel back to Soviet Russia. Oh, did I say Soviet Russia? I actually meant Cold War era Britain, as we discuss the 2011 feature film adaptation of Jean Le Carré's Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
There is a mole right at the top of British intelligence. He's been there for years.
For 25 years, we've been the only thing standing between Moscow and the Third World War.
I'm retired. You're outside the family. You're well placed to look into this for us now.
I'll do my utmost.
I know that it is one of these men. All I want from you is one code name. Tinker. Taylor. Soldier.
I need you to do something.
Well, I gotta tell you, Luke, this is exactly the kind of movie I don't enjoy watching.
Why is that?
Well, listen, no disrespect to this movie, which I actually think is quite good. But yeah, cold, drab, extremely dense and convoluted spy movies that are the opposite of James Bond. Generally not my idea of a good time. My brain is not good at following the plots of dense spy stories. That said, just initially as a sort of explanation for why I've never seen this movie, why I've never read any of John le Carré, and maybe it's just a preliminary apology for all that.
I had not seen this film. I did some years ago watch the very famous BBC TV series. I believe it was a BBC famous TV adaptation starring Alec Guinness. I don't remember it at the level of detail, but I have a thicker memory of it in terms of the vibes, which are somewhat different than in this film adaptation of it. Having said that, I have more of a relationship with Le Carré than you do. I've read several of his novels. I enjoy them. I think he's a really interesting and fun writer. I enjoyed Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy with some caveats, I suppose, that are in some ways similar to yours. I mean, I do think the limitations of this film, to some extent, I mean, it's a very slick and well-oiled and professionally executed kind of thing. I mean, it is an absolutely stacked cast. Like, every famous male British actor is in this movie, and they all give perfectly solid performances. But I mean, the main thing I remember about the Alec Guinness one, in contrast to this one, is that because it's, I think, over 5 hours hours long, it actually feels, particularly at the outset, rather slow. And that's important for a number of reasons. It's important because it actually makes the story, which, like a lot of Le Carré's stories, is incredibly intricate and, you know, lots of double and triple crossing and, you know, complex motivations and things like that. Lots of names. Just basic logistical things in the narrative that can be cumbersome. Those things are less cumbersome either in the format of a novel or in a longer adaptation for something like TV, because you just get to spend more time with everything. Like Le Carré is really good at building worlds. And in fact, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is merely one novel. I mean, there's others featuring George Smiley, who is probably fair to say Le Carré's most famous and iconic character. But the other implication of packing all this into a film that is just a little over 2 hours is that without having any room to breathe or sort of marinate in this world and in the characters, what you're left with is this kind of frantically paced series of overlapping intrigues where if your attention wavers for even a couple of minutes, there's going to be a new person introduced or a new flashback is going to reveal a detail of a character that's going to be absolutely critical to the plot. So that is a limitation for me. And furthermore, I think that Le Carré's prose, and I have an example of this that I found from the book that I'll read in a little bit, but I think Le Carré's prose are often able to communicate the themes that he's interested in ways that are difficult to do in a 2-hour movie without appearing a little bit heavy-handed. There's a few moments in this film where the dialogue, you know, right away it's clear, like, okay, so this is a thematic statement that a character is making, you know, this is thematic exposition. And it's not bad, it's, you know, it's reasonably well done, but it doesn't really match what Le Carré can do in a longer format and through his prose. Before we talk about the plot or the movie specifically, I think it's worth situating John Le Carré a little bit and explaining what makes him interesting. He was a man, you know, he passed away in 2020, fairly recently, who had a pretty heterodox amalgam of political views, I would say. I mean, towards the end of his life in particular, he had some, you know, pretty orthodox British liberal opinions. You know, he wasn't a big fan of the Labour Party under Corbyn, for example, but he was also extremely critical of Johnson and Brexit. In later interviews, you know, when he talks about Trump, it's, you know, it's pretty generic stuff. You can imagine, you know, comparisons between Trump and Putin and that sort of thing. But Le Carré also took a number of progressive stances throughout his life. He was critical of the war on terror. He was critical of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the British government's participation in it. He talked about the Bush administration's response to 9/11, characterizing it as worse than McCarthyism, worse than the Bay of Pigs in the long term, potentially more disastrous than the Vietnam War, beyond anything Osama bin Laden could have hoped for in his nastiest dreams. He was critical also of things like the Western policy towards Iran, you know, speaking specifically about the role played by both the British and American security services in the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in the 1950s and the installation of the Shah. So I think Le Carré's project also reflects his somewhat heterodox political point of view. The way he depicts the inner workings of security services, both during and after the Cold War in his novels, sharply deviates from the Manichaean norm, you know, in terms of how they're usually depicted. He's interested in characters and people and the complexity of what motivates them. I think that gives his novels a kind of moral ambiguity that one doesn't generally associate with popular fiction set during the Cold War. What's that scene in one of the Daniel Craig Bond films where Judi Dench gives the dressing down to the parliamentary committee, like on behalf of MI5?
That's right. It was in Skyfall where she was making the case that, listen, you idealists don't understand that we live in the darkness and therefore you need us more than ever.
Right. So that's how these kind of narratives, these spy narratives, you know, espionage stories, that's often how they frame themselves during the Cold War and then also after 9/11. A politics as sort of stupid and adolescent and sort of self-indulgently marinating in its own ersatz nuance as like a Christopher Nolan Batman movie or something. Le Carré is much more interesting than that. And his depiction of the security services is much less idealized. The famous line of the character Alex Lemus in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, he says, what do you think spies are? Moral philosophers measuring everything they do against the word of God or Karl Marx? They're not. They're just a bunch of seedy, squalid bastards like me. So Le Carré, who himself worked in the British security services, worked for, I believe, both MI5 and MI6. You know, his depiction of them is not a wholly noble one. Often his stories are about conflicts within the security services, sometimes between characters who are supposed to represent, you know, their more noble ideals, characters who are principled versus ones who aren't. But often he's really just dealing in shades of gray. I'll read just a little bit from a piece. This was by Emma Steiner, published in Jacobin in 2020 on the occasion of Le Carré's death. She writes, "Le Carré was obsessed with the idea of fidelity, and it explored it through both a personal and professional lens. His most famous character, George Smiley," so this is the character played by Gary Oldman in this film, "is embarrassingly publicly humiliated by his socialite wife, Anne Sercombe, as she engages in high-profile affairs. Yet he maintains his singular lonely devotion to his marriage to a certain point. Many of Le Carré's characters struggle with issues of infidelity, whether through experiencing it or committing it. Le Carré depicts lonely protagonists maintaining their dedication to their ideals in the face of overwhelming pressure to abandon them against the plethora of characters who justified their own abandonment of those ideals." Intelligence historians and scholars of espionage often use the acronym MICE to discuss the motivations for sources: money, ideology, compromise, and ego. But Le Carré understood from his own experience working for British intelligence that the line between source and handler, or between subject and object, are never as clear as they seem. I think that's very well put.
I actually have that piece open in front of me as well. And one passage that leapt out to me was, "The idea that Western intelligence and East German intelligence committed similar acts for similarly nebulous goals as a matter of policy was a bold assertion at the time, one that cut deeply against how the CIA and MI6 would have preferred to be depicted. In a milieu where intelligence work was seen as dashing and readers were titillated by Ian Fleming's James Bond novels, Le Carré instead offered them George Smiley, short, plump, betrayed, and characterized through his clockwork machinations rather than rugged flair. Instead of unambiguously fighting on the side of good against evil all the time, Smiley ruined lives and led innocent people to their deaths for British intelligence."
I will say, I think there are certain respects in which you can read Le Carré as a kind of small-c conservative. I mean, I think he is dealing in a kind of nostalgia. I don't know if I'd put it as strongly as Toby Manning did in his piece on Le Carré for Jacobin, but I nevertheless think this is worth considering, and I don't entirely disagree with it. Manning wrote, "Le Carré's fulminations against the Iraq War and Britain's Eton-dominated establishment have enhanced his radical reputation and were certainly refreshing amidst the chattering classes' Mogadon compliance of the last 25 years. Yet that Le Carré taught at Eton, sent his sons to public school, and took a very public stand against Corbyn's labor counts for little in the current goalpost-shifting climate, itself often as confounding as Le Carré's most elaborate double-bluff plot twists. Nevertheless, for leftists, Le Carré's work offers a brilliantly observed and narratively compelling insight into the British ruling class and into its consuming liberal ideology of anti-communism. It also offers an unrivaled insider guide to the contradictions of liberalism itself, personified by Smiley's rueful and perennial struggle between ruthlessness and mildness. Both he and Le Carré will be missed." So, you know, Manning did end that piece on a note of appreciation. And that to me is, you know, fundamentally where I come down on the question of John Le Carré. The novels are wildly entertaining. I've never read one that I didn't enjoy tremendously. They're all page turners in my experience. Anyway, that's a lot of throat clearing, so let's get to Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
Well, the protagonist is Smiley, played in this film by Gary Oldman in a very restrained, internalized performance. As the film begins, he is recently retired, but he's called back to service at MI6 after a disastrous mission. The head of MI6, who is known only as Control and is played by John Hurt, has sent a young spy named Prideaux, played by Mark Strong, on an intelligence-gathering mission to Budapest. In that mission, Prideaux is meant to rendezvous with a double-agent Russian general. But during the meeting, he realizes that this was a setup. The John Hurt character is ousted in disgrace, and Smiley is called in to find the source of a leak, apparently very near the top of MI6.
And specifically, the MI6 unit in question here is called the Circus. So it's like an elite panel of some kind, presumably within MI6. And, you know, I think the fact that Le Carré called it the Circus reflects his rather jaundiced view of aspects, at least, of the intelligence services after 1945, just as sort of, you know, soulless, amoral bureaucracies where theatrics are more important than principle.
Smiley is a difficult protagonist. As I said, the performance is fairly internalized, and it's also an open question exactly how much is inside this man. He seems like bureaucracy personified. Unlike James Bond, there's nothing cool about him. In fact, also unlike James Bond, he has a wife who's regularly cheating on him with other members of the department. Now, you mentioned how tricky sometimes it can be to follow all of the characters, and this, I gather, is particularly true of this movie compared to the book. And it helps that all of them are played by a very famous British actor, so you can keep track of them that way. But oftentimes, important character details, important double crosses are revealed very briefly. Sometimes characters' entrances and exits are partially obscured by the narrative. I have to wonder if this is as much a feature as a bug of this production. You know, the director, Thomas Alfredson, I suspect is being at times willfully obscure in the telling of the story to sort of create a sense in a way that's harmonious with the movie's visual style, which is this drab paste. I mean, it's a very precise looking movie. It's a very thoughtful looking movie. But just as there's often no difference between the Soviet Union and the Western democracies in this movie, so too is there often no difference between the characters that we see coming in and out. Nevertheless, some of the characters are Toby Jones as Percy Alleline. He's the tinker of the title.
Yeah, and he's part of a younger generation. He's extremely pro-American, and he's very excited to form ties with the CIA so that, you know, they can tap into the CIA's presumably much vaster intelligence network. And we're not really supposed to like him. He's very excited to operate as a sort of auxiliary of the United States, whether wittingly or not, and he hasn't quite seemed to grapple with the fact that Britain is now just a subordinate of the United States, and that its, you know, intelligence services, whatever they think of themselves, are actually a battleground on which, you know, Soviet and American intelligence are fighting things out. This character represents decline.
Alleline's deputy is Bill Hayden, played by Colin Firth, who's a sort of direct rival to the Smiley character. The titular soldier is Kieran Hines as Roy Bland.
He doesn't have as much to do in this movie as I was hoping, but just as an aside, I think Kieran Hines is great. He's been great in everything I've ever seen him in. He makes a brief appearance, of course, in Martin Scorsese's The Silence, and he brilliantly portrayed Julius Caesar on the TV series Rome. Big fan of Kieran Hines.
Parallel to that character is Toby Esterhaz, played by David Denkick. Those are some of the key suspects. There are also characters like the hitman Ricky Tarr, played by Tom Hardy.
Yeah, and throughout the movie, you know, through various machinations in Istanbul, where we see him go and meet with a Soviet agent who expresses her wish to defect, you know, he starts a love affair with her. She's going to ostensibly reveal to him the identity of the mole within the circus. But various points, it seems like Tom Hardy's character Tar may in fact be a traitor. There's also Gillum, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, who is tasked by Smiley with investigating Tar.
And he is the Tom Hardy character's boss.
Now, I would say it is actually impossible to run through all of the overlapping intrigues.
Do you want to tell them who the mole is?
Yeah, spoiler warning, we're going to tell you who the mole is. We'll save that for a little bit. I think it might be more useful, rather than explaining in all its intricacies the somewhat Byzantine plot, it might be more useful to talk about a few of the key scenes. A scene earlier in the movie that I think is critical is a scene in which Gary Oldman's character Smiley goes to meet with a former intelligence analyst named Connie, who has sort of been drummed out of the intelligence services, and she is living a pretty modest existence. Smiley notices some Johnny Walker Black and offers her some. She initially declines and says, oh, no, doctor's orders. And then he sort of says, come on. And, you know, she immediately obliges. I think the implication is that she's, you know, kind of depressed. And, the fact is it's her house and, she has Johnny Walker Black. So I think we can extrapolate she's drinking herself to death. But she explains to Smiley that she was drummed out because back in the 50s, she believed she'd identified a Soviet agent in the form of a guy called Alexei Polyakov, who she believed was either Polyakov was the mole or he was behind the mole. I don't think it matters. But she tried to make the case and no one would listen and she was drummed out of the service. Before Smiley leaves, the two of them have a conversation. And this is one of those moments of thematic exposition that I alluded to earlier. She's holding an old photo of Control, who's now passed away. This was the character played by John Hurt. And in his case, I think he has sort of an analogous arc to Connie, this former intelligence analyst, because after he's deposed, when things have gone awry in Budapest, he seems to die shortly after in disgrace or in ill health or some combination of the two. So she is sort of gingerly holding this old wartime photo of Control. And she says, all my lovely boys, that was a good time, George. And he replies, it was the war, Connie. And she says, a real war. Englishmen could be proud then. And then a little later on, she says, because he's come to see her about the mole that he's hunting. So I was right then, there is a mole. And as he's leaving, she says, if it's bad, don't come back. I want to remember you all as you were. So she, like Smiley and like Control, is meant to represent this older, somewhat idealized, by Le Carré that is, a generation of intelligence operatives. And I find this scene in some ways effective, but I mean, I do think you might criticize it for being a little bit heavy-handed. There's a ton of intrigue and plot twists in this movie, and then every so often you'll have an exchange like this where there's a few lines of dialogue that sort of reveal what the underlying themes are, and just, again, this kind of thing works a lot better in Le Carré's novels. Because when it's delivered this way, it really just comes across as like, oh yeah, remember the war when we had purpose, which is a little blander of a premise than it would be in one of Le Carré's novels.
All my boys. All my lovely boys. That was a good time, George.
It was the war, Connie.
A real war. Englishmen could be proud then.
I'm not sure where this fits into the discussion, but I was revisiting Mark Fisher's review of the film in Ghosts of My Life. I would have thought Mark Fisher would have liked this movie, both because it's a John le Carré adaptation and because the texture of it is so affectless. But actually, that seems to be what rubbed him the wrong way about it.
Yes.
He writes, "Where the details matter, this new version is lacking. Eras produce certain voices, certain faces. What's missing in Alfredson's version is something like the grain of the 1970s. Too often the actors seem like 21st century moisturized metrosexuals in 1970s drag, and bad drag at that. Presented with photographs of people from the 1970s, the cliched but accurate observation is that people looked so much older then. But the preposterously fresh-faced likes of Benedict Cumberbatch and Tom Hardy aren't nearly weathered enough to be convincing as 1970s rogue agents." Later he writes, "In the BBC version, the circus was an unprepossessing space, functional, dreary corridors leading into cramped offices. In Alfredson's version, Control's office looks more like something from a nightclub than what you would expect to see in MI6. There is much that is different, but nothing that is strong enough to displace the television version in the memory." You know, he's got a point. I remember long ago in this podcast when we watched All the President's Men, we were both very struck by how overwhelmingly, like, dirty and ugly everything looked as the sort of default look of what an office in the 1970s looked like. I do think Alfredson's style in this movie is effective, though. It may not be effective at evoking the 70s as they actually were, but it evokes a kind of existential malaise that's very specific to the 2010s. Certain scenes make me think of, like, if the Apple Store were designed to look like a Cold War era dystopia. It feels like a sort of, like, in terms of vibe, in terms of texture, it feels like a fusing of two different eras of alienation. You know what I mean?
I agree with you. Actually, something I liked about it, I've long enjoyed this essay on the film by Mark Fisher, but something I liked about Alfredson's interpretation is the way that when you get the scenes in places like Istanbul and Budapest, they look exactly the same as the scenes in London. So, you know, again, if this were a generic piece of Cold War fiction or a generic adaptation of same, you would have the scenes in places like Budapest immediately announce themselves through, like, they would put, like, a gray tint over the camera just to let you know, like, we're not in Kansas anymore. We're behind the Iron Curtain. Things are gray. Things are scary. And Alfredson chooses quite deliberately to shoot it all exactly the same way.
Which I appreciated very much. I mean, even as recently as, like, the Tetris movie that we watched last year, the trope of, like, behind the Iron Curtain is still so prevalent.
Yeah, behind the Iron Curtain, they won't let you have Tetris because that's how repressive it is. Pop music is something that you have to do underground because otherwise the KGB is going to kick down your door. Now, in this essay, I think Fisher does a very good job of situating the themes of the film and the novel, its source material, and kind of what the underlying concerns are. Also, and this is just useful exposition from our point of view since I haven't mentioned it yet, just situating the story in terms of the events it was responding to, because, of course, the novel came out, I believe, about 10 years after the famous case of Kim Philby and the Cambridge Five. So Fisher writes, in the novel, Le Carré reckoned with the sensational exposures that had both traumatized and titillated British society in the 1960s when Soviet double agents Guy Burgess, Donald MacLean, and Kim Philby were revealed to be operating right at the heart of the intelligence establishment. The book begins when Smiley is called out of retirement to search for a deep cover mole. It was, in fact, Le Carré who popularized this term in the Secret Intelligence Service, otherwise known as MI6. Tinker Taylor follows Smiley's circuitous pursuit and exposure of the traitor, who is ultimately revealed, okay, spoiler, to be Smiley's friend and rival, Bill Hayden. So that's character played by...
yeah, say it ain't so.
The character played by Colin Firth in the movie. We'll come back to him in a moment. One of the many men to have affairs with Smiley's semi-estranged wife, Anne. The narrative is suffused with what Paul Gilroy has called post-colonial melancholia. Smiley, Hayden, and their contemporaries, notably Jim Prideaux, the former head of the Scalp Hunters section, shot in the bungled operation that ultimately leads to the mole being uncovered, and Connie Sachs, the head of intelligence, dismissed when she comes uncomfortably close to the truth, have watched all the expectations born of imperial privilege slowly disappearing. Trained to empire, trained to rule the waves, all gone, all taken away, Sachs laments. Post-colonial melancholia is fed more by hostility toward the U.S. than it is by fear of the Soviets. Hayden and Smiley's boss, the irascible Control, are united in their loathing of Americans. When Control is maneuvered out of his position by the ambitious and very pro-American Percy Allaline, this seems to consolidate the sense of irreversible decline which hangs over the novel. England's glory lies in the past. The future is American. In the novel and its sequels, it is clear that Smiley's victory is temporary. His world is on the brink of disappearing. I'm going to read just a tiny bit more because I never tire of reading Mark Fisher. He continues, Smiley brings to mind English archetypes, both ancient and modern. What is the perpetually cuckolded Smiley returning to save his ailing kingdom, if not a Cold War King Arthur? Yet this is Arthur done in the style of T.S. Eliot's Prufrock, whose famous self-characterization as an attendant lord applies all too acutely to Le Carré's character as well. Deferential, glad to be of use, polite, cautious, and meticulous, full of high sentence but a bit obtuse, at times, indeed, almost ridiculous, almost at times, the fool. So that's from Eliot's famous poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Well, in some respects, a pathologically self-blinding figure, Smiley shares some of Prufrock's self-consciousness, when, in a scene that is powerfully played out in both the BBC and the film version, Smiley recalls his one face-to-face encounter with his counterpart, the Soviet spy chief Karla. He calls himself a fool. Crucially, he adds that he would rather be his kind of fool than Karla's.
I had to pick a side, George. It was an aesthetic choice as much as a moral one. The West has become so very ugly. Don't you think?
Did Carla ever consider having you take over the circus?
I'm not his bloody office boy.
What are you then, Bill?
So maybe we can talk, Will, about the scene near the end of the movie when Smiley confronts Hayden after, you know, this successful sting operation he does with the help of Tom Hardy's character Tar to expose Hayden. This is, I believe, the one scene in the movie where we see Gary Oldman's Smiley be angry. Now here, in a sense, Le Carré himself was deviating from the source material, that is the real world source material of the Cambridge Five, because I don't know much about the others, but Kim Philby was a committed communist. He finally, I think, defected to the Soviet Union and ended up dying there, I think just before the wall came down. The Haydn character does not seem to be any kind of an ideologue. I really like the dialogue in the film here. I'm not sure if this is taken from the novel or adapted from it. But in describing his motivations, Colin Firth's character says, "I had to pick a side, George. It was an aesthetic choice as much as a moral one. The West has become so very ugly." To this, George Smiley asks, "Who are you, Bill?" And Haydn replies, "I'm someone who has made his mark. It was nothing personal, George. I hope you understand that." So the Haydn character, I've been pronouncing it Haydn, it's actually Hayden, excuse me. The Haydn character, his motivations, I mean, I suppose you could read an ideological motivation into the way he frames his betrayal as, you know, an aesthetic choice as much as a moral one because the West is ugly now. I mean, maybe there's a subtext of that he sees a beauty in the USSR or in communism. At least in the context of the film, I kind of struggle to read it that way. My reading of this character is that he is simply self-interested. He is a kind of bureaucratically minded person whose loyalty to one ideology or another, one institution or another, is fundamentally transactional. And, you know, that obviously makes for a counterpoint, you know, it's an explicit counterpoint between Hayden and Smiley, but also figures like Connie and Control, who are all in this story, you know, meant to represent the principled, largely older generation of the security services, who have ideals and whose commitment to their jobs is rooted in some kind of principle as opposed to transaction.
This is maybe a non sequitur, but earlier this week I watched a Roger Corman movie, one of his last as a director, called Von Richthofen and Brown, a World War II aviation film from 1970, where the contrast in that movie was between Von Richthofen, who represented an earlier, more chivalrous kind of warfare, and Brown, who in the context of the film represented the rise of war as a kind of mass killing machine that would dominate the rest of the 20th century. Feels like every era you can plug the older, chivalrous, dying age versus the cold, brutal, unsentimental current age dichotomy into literally any era, and it would still seem resonant.
Yeah, and I mean, there are various ways to read that in relation to this film. I mean, I think it's largely left unspecified or unarticulated what exactly the contours of this older idealism are supposed to be. In fact, I think the point is more that it's idealism with a capital I, or it's principle with a capital P. It matters less what the details are. The film, I think, primarily treats the story as a character study, and the characters who are more the protagonists are just ones who have a commitment that is to something that is left, you know, largely unspecified, but is not transactional. I mean, Toby Manning, whose piece I was reading from earlier, he has a somewhat harsher reading of this aspect of the story. He notes, for example, that at a time this story came out, I mean, the British security services were quite literally smearing the Labour Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, as a Soviet agent. That was a widespread conspiracy theory, and we don't have time to go into it now. It's unbelievable this isn't better known, but I mean, there was I don't know if nearly is too strong a word, but I mean, there was a coup plot in Britain in the 70s against Harold Wilson's government. And part of the backstory to it was that I believe, I could be getting some of the details wrong, but I believe it was MI6 was planting information about how the Soviet Union had infiltrated the Labour Party and various, you know, senior positions of leadership in the trade union movement. And MI5 discovered this information and took it very seriously as a threat. Sometime, because we don't have time to go into this now, we'll have to talk about the documentary, The Plot Against Harold Wilson, that goes into considerable detail on this point. But anyway, just to go back to Toby Manning's piece, he says, with the Cold War a metaphor for the struggle between liberalism and the left, a bloody metaphor if you were Vietnamese, Le Carré's novel's anti-communism has a clear domestic corollary. Why raise the specter of a communist mole in the British state a decade after Kim Philby in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, when the working class has just deposed Edward Heath's government and your former MI5 colleagues are smearing Labour PM Harold Wilson as a communist mole? Tinker Tailor is as much an elegy for an establishment-dominated, pre-democratized, pre-war Britain as is Brideshead Revisited. So that would be a reading of this, which is certainly compelling. I would have to read the novel to know whether or not I agree with it. But there is a case, certainly, that this story, more so in the novel and in the TV adaptation, is more a sort of Cold War liberal tale than the character study that we're presented with in the 2011 adaptation. I do just want to return to this moment in the story when Smiley confronts Hayden.
There's one more point I want to read from Mark Fisher's essay. He says that very little political ambiguity comes out in Alfredson's, quote, depoliticized film, in which Smiley is simply a wronged hero who ultimately attains justice, Hayden is simply a traitor, and communism is simply an exotic period reference. The nickname for MI6, the circus, in fact openly acknowledges the aberrant enjoyment available to those who have crossed into this fictional Cold War. The use of the word depoliticized maybe draws a little bit of blood. Did you receive him as a sort of uncomplicated hero and Hayden as an uncomplicated villain the way that Fisher does? That's a bit of a leading question, isn't it?
Well, Fisher elsewhere in this essay, which I can't remember if I said the title already. This is called The Smiley Factor, if people want to read it for themselves. It's very good. Fisher criticizes Oldman's rendering of the character, drawing particular contrast with Alec Guinness's portrayal, which he much prefers. And I don't think he really buys the sort of sublimated way that Oldman chose to play Smiley. I think it's meant to be a sort of understated performance in which much is concealed, but I think I agree with Fisher here. I mean, you know, Gary Oldman is obviously an immensely talented actor, but I think the effect here is largely that we don't get that much sense of the character. He ends up coming across as, yeah, just a sort of uncomplicated hero. I do agree, though, with his characterization of this film as depoliticized. I mean, like I was saying before, you know, this is a film in which it's, you know, capital I idealism and capital P principle. Those are the sources of nostalgia in the film. Those are the noble character points from which its protagonists sort of draw their elan. And I actually want to read just a short section from the novel here, which the scene in the film is drawing on, because Le Carré renders it in a somewhat different way. I'm also reading this just because we haven't read any of Le Carré's prose yet, and because I think this kind of thing is an example of the wonderful way in which Le Carré deals in his core themes. Writing this scene, he says, Smiley saw with painful clarity an ambitious man born to the big canvas, brought up to rule, divide, and conquer, whose vision and vanities all were fixed, like Percy's, upon the world's game, for whom the reality was a poor island with scarcely a voice that would carry across the water. Thus, Smiley felt not only disgust, but, despite all that the moment meant to him, a surge of resentment against the institutions he was supposed to be protecting. So that, I think, succinctly conveys the kind of ambiguity that Le Carré so often deals in that makes him so interesting. We've read a lot from Mark Fisher. There's a particular thing I'd like to go out on, and I wasn't planning to read any more from Mark Fisher, but I absolutely love the way he closed the piece, and I can't resist. I want to share it. Piece closes, among other things, with an interesting analysis of the accents in the film, and he points out that the accents are kind of wrong. They're kind of off. He then begins his kind of closing thesis statement by talking about the Colin Firth character. So I'll just begin reading there. He says, the casting of Colin Firth as Hayden, however, at least allows us to see the character in a different way. The face of Ian Richardson, who would go on to play the Tory grandee in Machiavelli in the BBC television series House of Cards, provided a grey eminence image of British power in the 70s and 80s. I don't know who it was who said that Colin Firth looks like the midway point between the current British Prime Minister David Cameron and his deputy Deputy Nick Clegg, but the observation is very astute. The face of the British establishment no longer has the hawk-like puckishness of Richardson. It has the rumpled, casual youthfulness of Firth. One of the major problems with Alfredson's film is that it assumes the ruling values of the neoliberal world governed by youth and consumerism. Isn't that what American codes for in the Smiley novels? Richard Sennett has argued that the chronic short-termism of neoliberal culture has resulted in a corrosion of character, a destruction of permanence, loyalty, and the capacity to plan. Isn't Smiley's allure tied up with the possibilities of character itself? In the 1970s, Smiley showed us all the inadequacies, squalid compromises, and subterranean brutalities of social democracy. So there, what Fisher's referring to, I suppose, is the fact that the British state became broadly social democratic after 1945, but, you know, it also was explicitly aligned with the United States during the Cold War. It's like there was the NHS and, yeah, there was also this big security state. He closes this way. Then, that's in the 1970s, Smiley's doubts and his failings prompted us to imagine a better world even as we struggled to resist his blankly and perversely comforting avuncularity. When that better world seems, if anything, further away, it takes all our effort to resist the lure of nostalgia for the social democratic world of which Smiley was both the conscience and the dirty secret. I love that as a closing for this essay because it really does get at the ambiguity in Le Carré that's interesting. And on that note, I want to go out with something that the writer Tony Barley said of Le Carré in the 1980s. This is from a book published in 1986 called Taking Sides, The Fiction of John Le Carré. Barley puts the contradiction in Le Carré this way. The irony in Le Carré's fiction is that a sound basis for commitment is always either sought or mourned for its absence, and yet when genuine commitment appears, invariably in communism, it is treated as incomprehensible. It is those kind of tensions that consistently make Le Carré such an interesting writer and make a film like this one, which I think, despite some strengths, is inferior to the TV adaptation starring Alec Guinness. This adaptation, you know, despite being, you know, a very intricate and in some places difficult to follow series of nonstop intrigues, it really is a rich text. There's a lot to plumb here. And I enjoyed talking about it very much.